Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. Some are annoying. Some are a delight. Insects. In the Midwest of my childhood, mosquitoes were incredibly annoying, biting me repeatedly when I was trying to wander along a lake or even sit outside and try to carry on a conversation. But on the opposite end of the spectrum, lightning bugs lit up the night, signaling to one another, unaware their blinking put on a show for any alert child. Lightning bugs, or fireflies, which, to be more precise, are bioluminescent beetles, may be spotted in every state but Hawaii. Unfortunately, they are harder to find in western states. I have never seen one in Oregon. Have you? Well, all four of today's poems place insects on center stage, which seems appropriate for August. The title of today's episode, Insects Among Us. Our first poem opens with a question. Don't you remember them? In The Bugs of Childhood, the poet Danusha Lemirez poses this question. She implies insects meant more when we were so much shorter, closer to the level of ants and caterpillars, and when we were so much younger and more inquisitive about all the strange small creatures who shared our world. This is from Danusha Lemirez's 2024 volume, Blade by Blade, The Bugs of Childhood. Don't you remember them? Furred caterpillar legs moving along your arm, each follicle prickling beneath their touch. A ladybug crumpling its underwings as it tucked them back beneath its glossy shell. Rows and rows of ants hefting their white eggs. The fly's head, antennae bent under the careful work of forelegs as it bathed its large composite eye. One, no bigger than a speck, left tufts of foam, another a pool of green in your palm. Some rolled themselves into a pill-shaped ball at the slightest touch, while others, no matter how you tried, refused. What was it about the workings of their small bodies, the click of the mandibles, or the steady pulse of the thorax, so nipped at the center it seemed tied with string? Almost electric, the way they zipped through the grass, sunlight caught in iridescence. How the dirt glinted and shimmered, how the blind earth once writhed alive in your hands. Danusha Lemirez, The Bugs of Childhood. This is definitely a poem of memory, recovering earlier enthusiasms. So it's also implicitly optimistic. We can recover those enthusiasms if, that is, we are comfortable with the language of feeling, each furry leg of the caterpillar as it moves along your arm's follicles, and the language of seeing, the tucked-in underwings of the ladybug, or the steady pulse of the thorax of another unnamed insect, maybe a wasp. So nipped at the center, it seemed tied with string. The thorax would be the middle of the three chief divisions of the insect's body. We could think of it like the waist, tighter and more narrow than a Barbie doll's. The speaker is not exactly a junior scientist, though she names caterpillars, ladybugs, ants, and a fly, perhaps the most well-known of insects to a child, others are anonymous. What insect could that be that's no bigger than a speck and left tufts of foam? Is that some kind of beetle, perhaps? Is this anonymous insect trying to attract a mate with the foam, or is this secretion a reaction to danger? A defensive release. What about the insect that left a a pool of green in the speaker's palm. I'm certainly not faulting the poet. These descriptive references accurately capture the sense of wonder a child would bring to her backyard world. As the final line indicates, the dirt is alive. Again, this is Danusha Lemira's The Bugs of Childhood. Don't you remember them? Furred caterpillar legs moving along your arm, each follicle prickling beneath their touch. A ladybug crumpling its underwings as it tucked them back beneath its glossy shell. Rows and rows of ants hefting their white eggs. The fly's head, antennae bent under the careful work of forelegs as it bathed its large composite eye. One, no bigger than a speck, left tufts of foam. Another, a pool of green in your palm. Some rolled themselves into a pill-shaped ball at the slightest touch, while others, no matter how you tried, refused. What was it about the workings of their small bodies, the click of the mandibles, or the steady pulse of the thorax, so nipped at the center it seemed tied with string? Almost electric, the way they zipped through the grass, sunlight caught in iridescence, how the dirt glinted and shimmered, how the blind earth once writhed alive in your hands. Danusha Lemira's The Bugs of Childhood. As noted, this is a poem of memory, but the speaker implies the dirt, the air, the grass remain alive with insect life if we are willing to slow down and take it in. Our next poem locks us in the present. The speaker examines a wounded cricket with a magnifying glass. We're not in a lab, we're on the outside porch with the most curious speaker. The wounded cricket is stunned, and that gives the speaker ample opportunity to examine her. And it is a female cricket. The males chirp, but the females, of course, can hear the chirping. This is Robert Wrigley's I Want to Praise Her Parts. I want to praise her parts, helm, gorget, placard, greave, but her wounds, sudden gust, window, suggest more than exoskeletal dishevelment and worry me. Even my lying on my belly on the porch, looming over and looking at her through a magnifying glass, does not make her leap or fly, if she can. She's almost an inch long, her antennae upright and gently curved, her thighs, if that's what they are, the muscular-seeming upper parts of her cricket legs, tense and tapered, large hypnotic black eyes, the long stiletto of her ovipositor, a dozen shades of amber she is. I would like to kiss her. She's so clear to me through the glass. Then I see her left ear, just below the knee of her foreleg, elongate, lighter hued, and I cannot take my eyes from it. When she rotates a quarter inch away from me and appears to be gathering herself to leap and fly, it turns out she doesn't, which may or may not be because I have begun softly to sing. Robert Wrigley's I Want to Praise Her Parts. There's a parade of terms right in the poem's opening sentence. Helm, gorget, plankert, greave. Rather than precise entomological terms, Wrigley adopts the language of a knight's armor to detail the appearance of the cricket. Armor protecting the knight's throat, abdomen and waist, and the leg below the knee. her exoskeleton, the hard cuticle encasing her body. He detects her ovipositor, the tube-like organ for laying eggs. He says her ears are below her knees, and, weirdly, he's right. The membrane capable of vibration is located on her front legs. Of course, he's not pretending to be a scientist in a lab. He guesses he's looking at her thighs, for example. Her curved antennae, her feelers, may be as long as her armor-like body. I appreciate the fact that we gaze with the speaker. We take in every millimeter of her impressively solid, yet also delicate body. Her armor has been banged up, and he's looking intently with his magnifying glass. Inadvertently, he's encouraging her to rest and heal after a sudden gust of wind blew her into a window, and while she rests, recovers, gathers her strength after crashing into the window, he sings to her. She should be accustomed to males of her species chirping to get her attention, but this singing giant above her is a whole new creature for her to reckon with. Again, this is Robert Wrigley's I Want to Praise Her Parts. I want to praise her parts, helm, gorget, plankert, greave, but her wounds, sudden gust, window, suggest more than exoskeletal dishevelment and worry me. Even my lying on my belly on the porch, looming over and looking at her through a magnifying glass, does not make her leap or fly, if she can. She's almost an inch long, her antennae upright and gently curved, her thighs, if that's what they are, the muscular-seeming upper parts of her cricket legs, tense and tapered. Large, hypnotic black eyes, the long stiletto of her ovipositor, a dozen shades of amber she is. I would like to kiss her. She's so clear to me through the glass. Then I see her left ear, just below the knee of her foreleg, elongate, lighter hued, and I cannot take my eyes from it. When she rotates a quarter inch away from me and appears to be gathering herself to leap and fly, it turns out she doesn't, which may or may not be because I have begun softly to sing. Robert Wrigley's I Want to Praise Her Parts. Let's move from Wrigley's front porch and go indoors, specifically to a 39th floor apartment in New York City, where a grasshopper appears, completely out of place. The speaker can't fathom how it arrived so far up and tries to puzzle that out. Early in the poem, the speaker wonders if the hopper's presence in this unlikely zone may inspire him to believe in God again, but he writes God with a lowercase g. I presume he's being ironic to think that one insect could prompt his spiritual reevaluation. Or maybe he's being comically cynical. At the poem's end, he dismisses the role of the divine. Yet how to account for this mysterious, seemingly miraculous appearance? The author is Pedro Petri, who was born in 1944 in Puerto Rico, raised in Manhattan, served in Vietnam, and died in 2004. This is Pedro Petri's poem, Ode to a Grasshopper. I hope the only reason that I am this pre-autumn afternoon in the privacy of my suspicious living room, grant myself permission to believe in God once again, is solely because I saw an unexpected grasshopper staring at my thoughts on the table that keeps the telephone from having a mind of its very own. At first, I was startled, and then I was startled less at the sight of this insect put together in green details to pay me an afternoon visit 39 floors above floor level in my high-rise hobo apartment, Miracle on 53rd Street. Grasshopper hopped all the way 39 floors above floor level to deliberately invade my privacy, and I didn't mind at all. After Grasshopper assured me it didn't speak English or Spanish or Chinese with an Italian accent, so we hit it off right away. "You mind your own business, and I will not ask you any personal questions, aside from how the hell did you get here?" I've never written a poem about grasshoppers this high up before, and I know it wasn't something my non-existing paintbrushes conceived behind my back, and the only grass I have here is to smoke and not hop around in until I get dizzy and levitate. There has to be a mistake. Or did the grasshopper take the elevator to the 39th floor and enter my apartment without knocking? To make it obvious, grasshoppers have the right to remain silent also, and give credit to the desert for his arrival, and not know Almighty, the only other mystery capable. Pedro Petri, Ode to a Grasshopper. This title sounds formal. Typically, the language of the ode is dignified, even elevated. The standard ode might work with numerous metaphors to elaborate complex ideas. Pedro Petri does not do that here. He seems to be casual in his form, but there's still much to try to unpack here. The first line consists of two syllables, "I hope," and they're in parentheses. Why? I don't know. His lines are short, and he avoids all punctuation after the parentheses in line one. No commas, no semicolons, no periods. That means, when reading aloud, I have to determine where to pause, where one thought seems somewhat complete. I have to determine if some lines are intended to sound like a question. That leaves the tone of the poem up to the reader to sort out. When is he being serious? When is he goofing with us? For example, he says the table in his living room keeps the phone from having a mind of its very own. Well, how does it do that? He doubts the grasshopper was looking for grass because the only kind the speaker has is to smoke and not hop around in until I get dizzy and levitate. Other lines suggest maybe he wrote this after smoking. Robert Wrigley's poem centered on a quiet act of concentration. Petri's poem is a bit jumpy, and some of his thoughts move in and out of focus. His hopper is put together in green details, though the speaker does not anatomize those details as Wrigley had done with his wounded cricket. Instead, the absolute strangeness of this out-of-place hopper is emphasized. I think it would be disorienting to find a hopper on the streets of New York City, let alone inside an apartment on the 39th floor. Again, this is Pedro Petri's Ode to a Grasshopper. I hope the only reason that I am this pre-autumn afternoon in the privacy of my suspicious living room, grant myself permission to believe in God once again, is solely because I saw an unexpected grasshopper staring at my thoughts on the table that keeps the telephone from having a mind of its very own. At first, I was startled, and then I was startled less at the sight of this insect put together in green details to pay me an afternoon visit 39 floors above floor level in my high-rise hobo apartment, Miracle on 53rd Street. Grasshopper hopped all the way 39 floors above floor level to deliberately invade my privacy, and I didn't mind at all. After Grasshopper assured me it didn't speak English or Spanish or Chinese with an Italian accent, so we hit it off right away. You mind your own business, and I will not ask you any personal questions aside from, how the hell did you get here? I've never written a poem about grasshoppers this high up before, and I know it wasn't something my non-existing paintbrushes conceived behind my back, and the only grass I have here is to smoke and not hop around in until I get dizzy and levitate. There has to be a mistake. Or did the grasshopper take the elevator to the 39th floor and enter my apartment without knocking? To make it obvious, grasshoppers have the right to remain silent also, and give credit to the desert for his arrival and not know Almighty, the only other mystery capable. Pedro Petri, Ode to a Grasshopper. Petri's speaker does not pick up his surprise guest, which is good, because when a person picks up a grasshopper, the grasshopper is likely to vomit in that person's hands as a defensive mechanism, so you can't take it personally when this happens. Let's stay indoors for our final poem today, Thomas Hardy's An August Midnight. Picture Hardy, best known as a novelist for Far From the Madding Crowd and other works, back in roughly 1900 as he works in his study in southwestern England, the grandfather clock ticking, his space lit by an oil lamp, dipping his pen into the inkwell on his desk. And some guests arrive, various insects with their earth secrets. Their code of communication is meaningful to them as Hardy's words on the page are to him. The speaker stops writing at his desk while his guests, four of them, demand his attention. This is Thomas Hardy's 12-line poem, An August Midnight. A shaded lamp and a waving blind, and the beat of a clock from a distant floor. On this scene enter, winged, horned, and spined, a long legs, a moth, and a Dumbledore, while mid my page there idly stands a sleepy fly that rubs its hands. Thus meet we five, in this still place, at this point of time, at this point in space. My guests besmear my new-penned line, or bang at the lamp and fall supine. God's humblest they, I muse, yet why? They know earth's secrets that know not I. Thomas Hardy's An August Midnight. Unlike today's other three poets, Hardy relies on rhymes to add a musical tone to this quiet scene. Blind, spined. Distant floor, Dumbledore. Stands, hands, and other rhymes. I suppose there's one word that jumped out at you in that poem. Dumbledore. In the pre-Harry Potter world, before Dumbledore became known as the headmaster at the Hogwarts Wizard School, Hardy seems to use it to mean a large cockchafer beetle that's destructive to vegetation, or maybe he's using it to refer to a bumblebee. It may be a term peculiar to the Dorchester region of England, where Hardy lived over 100 years ago. It's just one of four guests in his study, one that either smears the ink in the line he just wrote or collapsed after banging into his lamp. The others are longlegs, which may be a two-winged insect that resembles a mosquito but does not bite. A moth? And again, the speaker's not specific about what he sees, and maybe he's unsure. And a sleepy fly. Hardy's in his study. He's not in a lab with a microscope. It's good enough that he distinguishes four insects here. We're not expecting him to give us the Latin species name. More to the point, the speaker's not annoyed so much as bewildered. What do the insects know? What do they want from him? Again, this is Thomas Hardy's An August Midnight. A shaded lamp and a waving blind, and the beat of a clock from a distant floor. On this scene enter, winged, horned, and spined, a long legs, a moth, and a Dumbledore, while mid my page there idly stands a sleepy fly that rubs its hands. Thus meet we five in this still place, at this point of time, at this point in space. My guests besmear my new-penned line, or bang at the lamp and fall supine. God's humblest they, I muse, yet why? They know earth secrets that know not I. Thomas Hardy, An August Midnight. At a later date, I would like to share poems on fireflies, walking sticks, a praying mantis, butterflies, and more. Currently, there are over 40 episodes of Poems for Company available on the KMUN.org website. Our theme music is Philip Auberg's Going to the Sun from a CD, Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company.